I took a trip last month to the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, to visit a high school friend who's an emergency physician there.
Hi there.
Hello.
I'm Dr. Grossman.
Hi.
I know Dr. Grossman as Daniel Grossman. He's 37, and he's talking to a patient who says he's been fatigued and having heart palpitations.
Well, I just noticed I had gotten a bad cold, and so I was in bed a couple of days, and I could tell my heart was skipping beats all the time. So I'm like, I've been in several times and had all kinds of tests done on my heart.
Okay.
After a few more questions, Daniel recommends some blood work.
So the reality is we probably won't come up with a specific answer today, which I recognize is pretty frustrating, but we'll do our best to see if we can get some things started and some of the more, you know, obvious things crossed off the list for you. Does that sound good?
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
What you can't hear is that both the patient and the doctor are in wheelchairs. The patient because he's visiting the emergency room, and the doctor because of a spinal cord injury less than a year ago, and he's already back to work. Daniel's memories of the accident are fuzzy. He was mountain biking with his friend Ron last September in northern Minnesota. It was the end of the day, and they decided to take one more run.
Ron was in front of me, and I was following behind him. And the next thing I know, I woke up with people around me.
You don't remember what happened?
No idea. I think I went up a little hill, and that's about it.
You're a doctor, obviously. Did you try to self-diagnose as you were trying to figure out what had happened?
At some point, and the timing of it is a little bit shady, we called my brother from the trail, and my brother's a neurologist. And I said, Aaron, I can't feel my legs. And he said, well, ask Ron if you're moving your legs. Ron, am I moving my legs? He's like, no. And my back hurt. So putting two and two together, we figured there was a spinal cord injury.
And did you realize right away that you may not walk again?
I would say it took me to the helicopter to realize that.
Daniel was airlifted to a hospital in Minneapolis, where he learned he had suffered a spinal cord injury between his 7th and 8th thoracic vertebrae. He was paralyzed below his mid-abdomen, just a few inches above his belly button. He survived because he was wearing a helmet. He spent 4.5 months in 3 hospitals and has had to relearn to do basic things like lifting himself from his bed to his wheelchair, and things that aren't talked about as much, like going to the bathroom when you can't feel the lower half of your body. Daniel has to time his bathroom breaks based on what he's had to eat and drink and carries an extra pair of pants just in case. He's also had to renovate his apartment so he can do things many of us take for granted.
We have created a cutout under the sink. We've also created a fully wheel-in bathroom shower so that I can move easily in a special shower commode chair from a toilet into the shower. We've added grab bars, and we've tried to make things as safe as possible.
He puts that special wheelchair on the right side of his bed at night so he can get to it in the morning. After showering, he returns to his bed, gets dressed there, and then his primary wheelchair is on the other side of his bed so he can go to work. He's also made some adjustments to the rest of his apartment, raising the dining room table so he can get his wheelchair underneath, lowering the sink so he can clean dishes on his own. And he relies heavily on technology, using Amazon's Alexa for things that will save him a couple of wheelchair transfers, like turning on and off the lights.
Alexa will turn on my TV. Alexa will change the temperature in the room. Alexa will lock the door.
You also have started relying on Instacart.
So I'm happy to go to the grocery store. It just is a fairly inefficient process to get out of my car, load some groceries, and, you know, get back in the car. If I can limit the number of transfers and use a food delivery service, I will. I realize that not everyone has access to all of these things, and I think that's really important to remember.
Daniel's on a doctor's salary, but on average, being disabled costs people thousands of dollars a year, and many need to rely more on friends and family. Daniel's parents moved into town for 6 months after his accident to help him.
There was a moment after your parents had been here for a while, when you apologized to your father.
So my parents are in their 70s. They have essentially retired from their jobs as university professors. And part of that retirement plan was likely not to have their son have a life-changing injury. I said, Dad, this isn't what you planned for your retirement, and I'm really sorry about that. I apologize that you are here with me instead of doing the things that I think you should be doing. And he, for the first time I've seen it, broke down in tears and was visibly angry with me and said, don't ever apologize again. This is what I signed up for the day you were born. This is my role as a father. Don't ever apologize again.
In February, just 5 months after his accident, Daniel went back to work at two jobs. He's medical director of the health insurance startup Bright Health, and four times a month, he pulls shifts as an ER doctor at the Mayo Clinic. To get to work these days, he commutes an hour and a half from Minneapolis to Rochester, Minnesota for his ER shifts, and he drives himself.
So I pull up to the car, lock my brakes, and then hop in. Typically, my legs spasm a little bit as we go here.
The whole process takes just under 5 minutes. He has to lift himself into the car, then take apart his wheelchair and put it in the back seat.
I'm telling you, these YouTube guys make it look like the simplest thing in the world. I buckle my seatbelt so I don't fall out. What I've learned through all of this is life is one big experiment, and you just have to figure out what works for you.
Once he's on the road, Daniel uses a system of hand controls to drive.
There's a knob on the wheel that I'm using with my left hand, and I'm using the hand controls with my right hand. I elected to get right-sided hand controls instead of left-sided hand controls because I'm so tall that with the left-sided hand controls, my knees would always hit the rods that go underneath it. And now we're just driving like normal.
Driving like normal to a job that is anything but, even for someone who isn't paralyzed.
Getting back to work as an emergency physician initially seemed like a pretty big hurdle. You run around a lot. You're doing procedures that require awkward positioning over the patient, whether that's putting in a large IV in someone's neck or groin called a central line, or whether putting in a breathing tube when someone is having difficulty breathing called an intubation. All of these are situations that you find yourself in that are critical and that require you to sort of adapt your positioning based on the situation.
Because usually the doctor would be standing up and looking down at the patient when they do something like that?
Standing up and looking down, moving around, moving their head and body.
So what did you do about that?
When it was time to get back practicing and trying things, we did what's called simulation. We take mannequins and we can practice intubating them, or doing central lines, or doing lumbar punctures, a spinal tap. We also set up patient rooms in the ER at Mayo and had mock patients, usually like a friend's kids, so I could learn how to navigate the room.
So this is teaching you the technical aspects. What about when you started finally interacting with patients? Was there a difference by the fact that you wheeled into the room?
Some are flabbergasted. Some are rude to me, and that has been like the minority of patients. Little kids have asked me, why are you in a wheelchair? And it's opened up a conversation about accidents, about life-saving use of helmets. It's also very clearly broken down barriers with patients because they know that you have gone through something. And so they're much more willing to listen to you when you offer advice. You can relate to them. Maybe not specifically to their situation, but you can find a way to relate to the fact that they're going through health problems.
Because this is a big complaint about doctors in general, is that people feel that they're thinking about everything technically and they don't have enough emotion or empathy for the patient.
Yeah, there's an empathy that's missing in medicine. And it's not taught in medical schools. Mm. And it's not taught in residency. And I will be the first to say that I have not led the most empathetic clinical practice that I could have. I think I've done a poor job of caring for patients with spinal cord injuries. And I think my injury has changed my practice. I understand that a patient is scared. I understand that their family members don't have a clue about what's going on. When I say, I know your life is about to change or is changing today, they look at me and they know that I know what I'm talking about.
Hmm.
And it's pretty emotional.
9 months ago, Daniel had to relearn how to do basic things like lifting himself or transferring from his bed into his wheelchair. And from his wheelchair to the ground and back.
Now reposition my feet.
Yep.
Be straight. Bring my knees in.
And you want to tuck them back as far as you can.
Yep.
Today, Daniel is more comfortable in his wheelchair and has gone back to work as an ER doctor. But he's still concerned about falling out of the chair, something that has already happened to him a few times, including while he was staying at a hotel near the Mayo Clinic.
I was transferring from the toilet to my wheelchair.
Mm-hmm.
And I missed the transfer. I'd practiced this transfer a whole bunch of times, but I missed it. And I ended up on the ground. Now, I had also practiced getting from the ground up back onto the chair. But it's different to do that in physical therapy on a mat than it is to do naked in the middle of a tile floor with the chair not solidly held or against the wall.
Mm-hmm.
So I called a nurse from Mayo, and she came and helped me get up. And that was my worst fear. So later that evening, one of the occupational therapists from Mayo came over to my hotel room, and we practiced transfers from toilet to chair, toilet to chair, toilet to chair. And she's like, okay, you've got it. I said, good, let's do a few more. And then the next day, we did it again. And the only answer to overcoming the fear and the skill is to keep doing things until you're comfortable doing it.
How are you?
How are you?
Good.
On the day we visited, Daniel took us up to the third floor of the hospital, where many doctors recognized him. This is where he started learning how to navigate the world from a wheelchair.
This is the acute rehab unit, and I was up here for 64 days. So this is the room I was in, 42. It was home for 2 months.
What is it like to be back here?
It feels good. I mean, I graduated from this place, and sort of it feels like a bit of a homecoming and a bit of a graduation. And
how are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. Back to work. I see you.
Back to work.
Jeez. No rest.
Hey, can't rest. Got things to do.
Yeah, you do. Got life to live, right? Good to see you.
You too.
So you feel like you have good memories of this place?
Yeah. Look, I hated being here from the sense of I'm in the hospital, but it was really good for me. The nursing care is fantastic. The physicians are great. And I, at the end of the day, have really, really positive memories of learning how to get back on my feet, so to speak. Hey, how are you?
I'm doing well.
Dr. Kristen Garlinger leads Daniel's rehab team at Mayo. She pops out of her office to tell Daniel how impressed she is by the speed of his recovery.
I think that, you know, settle. It takes a special individual to take barriers and make them into opportunities, and I think you were that way before injury, and so that's kind of what gave you the upper hand compared to maybe other individuals who don't have that inherent personality. Yeah.
Personality matters in other areas of life as well, including dating. Daniel is single, and I asked him about that.
What about the single part? What do you think that your relationships will look like in the future?
I would love to be in a relationship and would love to have children. That is a primary goal of mine, and so therefore a big fear of mine as well. But plenty of stories exist of people starting relationships after having spinal cord injuries and having children. I don't see why that would be any different for me.
Have you had a date yet?
Yep.
Yeah?
I've had a few dates, and it is a self-selected population because I'm pretty upfront about the fact that I'm in a wheelchair. And so either they're okay with it or they knew me before.
Hmm.
Is it easy? No.
It sounds like none of this is easy.
None of this is easy. It will all become easier. It's only been 9 months.
Right.
And I have to keep that in perspective.
According to the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation, people with spinal cord injuries are 2 to 3 times more likely than the general population to show signs of severe depression. People with spinal cord injuries are also at a higher risk of attempting suicide.
You wrote in one of your early blog posts, because you started blogging about what was going on, that you were able to be mostly in good spirits, but you were sometimes sad and it would come and go.
Yeah, early on, I think I realized what the ramifications were, not just for me, but for everyone in my life. And I sort of had to pick between two divergent paths really early on. Option A is you are paralyzed. What are you going to do about it? Option B is you are paralyzed. Let's sit and wallow in self-pity.
Hmm.
And I decided for option A. And honestly, I think most people do decide for option A. But option B seems really easy. That like self-pity component seems pretty reasonable.
There are approximately 300,000 Americans living with spinal cord injuries. And Daniel's not the only one who's also a doctor. One is Dr. Francisco Sanchez at Harvard, who recorded himself doing procedures to help Daniel learn how to do them. Another is right here at the Mayo Clinic, Dr. Robert Brown, a neurologist who has used a wheelchair since he was 14 and who became a mentor for Daniel during his recovery.
And you've got, by the way, a perfectly pressed suit on, a perfectly tied tie. Daniel's been talking to us about how difficult it is sometimes to get dressed.
Yeah.
How'd you make this happen?
Well, as Daniel perhaps mentioned to you, I've used a wheelchair to get around for a long time. Mm-hmm. This dates back, 40 plus years. And so this is the type of thing you just get used to, if you will, as years go by. And one was one of the things Daniel and I talked about when I first got to meet him. And we talked about this transition to the new normal, if you will, in Daniel's life and the various aspects of one's world that one needs to get used to as you participate not only in your personal life, but in your professional life. You just get very used to how to put things together in the morning, you know, as you're getting ready to come in. And
you just get used to it.
You get used
practice
to it.
Practice makes
it,
perfect.
And it doesn't take very long. It probably doesn't take me a whole lot longer than it would somebody who's not using a wheelchair. My message to Daniel was that one's life can be absolute, as full, and as much of a celebration of life as it would have been prior to the accident.
One of the things our listeners can definitely hear from you is you're very upbeat.
Yeah.
How important is the attitude? And yeah. Have you said anything to Daniel about that?
Yeah. Well, we talked about that early on. And my immediate perspective as I got to know Daniel in that setting is he has a very upbeat personality by nature. And that's the way I was as well. When I was initially paralyzed 40 years ago, and I think my parents would be the first to say this, I was the one who was trying to reassure them that this is going to be okay. You know, we'll just work through it over the course of time. It'll be fine. And that was just in my nature at age 14 that for whatever reason, and I think it's a very good thing that it was the case, that the more you're able to appreciate what you're able to do, despite the fact you're using a wheelchair to get around, as opposed to the things that you can't do or an obstacle in your place, you're going to be much better off and readily be able to work through whatever obstacles that might be in front of you.
As we continued to talk to Dr. Brown, Daniel was listening across the room. He wheeled over to say something himself.
So we've talked a lot about inspiration. And when you rolled into my room the first day, pristinely dressed, and you didn't treat me like a patient, you treated me like a colleague. And that, for me, was actually inspirational, because you came in and said, you know, you can do all the things you want to do, and you have one choice to make, and that is, do you want to do the things, or do you want to choose an alternative path, as you described? And I want to say thank you, because you immediately alleviated my fear of travel. You immediately alleviated my fear of not being able to get back to a profession that I cared deeply and passionately about. And you showed me that you can live professionally, you can live personally, and you can do all of these things successfully. So as much as we've harped on the word inspirational, the impact you made on my life when you came and visited multiple times without any difficulty was incredible, and I want to say thank you.
Well, thank you. It means the world to me that you say that, Daniel. And as a colleague and now a close friend, it's just fantastic for me to see how well you're doing, and for many, many years to come, I'll look forward to assisting in any way I can.
Thank you.
Daniel still keeps the helmet he was wearing the day of his accident. It's cracked, but it also saved his life. He's also started biking again, on a bike operated with hand pedals.